There. Today I'm here with Isaac. He's a AI consultant out of Alexandria in Virginia. He recently launched a course on generative AI with code generation. And he is also building a lot of products. So I'm very excited to talk to you about the hot topic these days, Isaac. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. The course has been going really well, and it's been a blast.
Yeah, perfect. So before we jump into what this course is about, maybe for those of you, of our listeners who don't know you, could you give us a brief introduction of yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess I've done a lot of things in my professional career. I started out going into the business side of things and product management, and then I took a hiatus to teach dance for a couple of years, and then I came back and I was more interested in the technical coding side of things, and so that's kind of when I started getting into data science. I did data science consulting at some startups. I worked as a product manager and lead data scientist at a company that was working with financial data for hedge funds and things like that. And recently, I left my job a few months ago at a AI research lab in order to start my own business. And since then, I've been doing courses. We've got this AI coding course that we're going to be talking about today. There was a retrieval course, a RAG course, that was just launched as well, and consulting with several companies on increasing their ability to develop quicker using, the modern AI coding paradigms, as well as improving, retrieval accuracy and for their commercial products. Building a couple of products of my own, but nothing released quite yet. But that's who I am.
Oh, perfect. Thank you. Your consultancy is all about AI, I guess, and this is the hot topic these days. If you're a developer and haven't checked out at least first steps with Copilot or any other coding CLI, you might miss out on a few important changes in the industry. But yet, even though if you have tried it out, there is a couple of things that are hard to reason about, like what is RAG, what is fine-tuning, and which models do I use, and stuff like that. Could you shed some light on these questions?
Yeah, I think when people have been developing for a long time, and there's a lot that stayed the same. If you have a big problem and you want to solve it and you don't know how to solve it, you want to break it into small pieces. There's like lots of these principles that you've always used in development that you still want to use. I don't anticipate that ever going away. But it can be a little bit hard when you start using AI for coding for a couple of reasons. It can be very challenging because I think most of these AI products, they kind of push or encourage you to work in much, much larger steps. That's a problem for two reasons. Partially because you have to plan so far in ahead if you work in big chunks that a lot of what you thought you wanted ends up not being the case. The second thing is when you have these big chunks, it's a lot harder to review. If you've got 3,000 lines of code or 50 features that you've developed, you're just gonna like banging away with it. It might work pretty well, but trying to go through and figure out and fix all of the edge cases is, extremely challenging. And so it can be tricky to use. It can provide incorrect information at times. When I was doing a demo for the course, I was showing how, like, in real time as I was live coding to show them some of the challenges with AI coding. It's things like I was like, hey, change this layout, and it's like, great, I can fix that, let me just downgrade Tailwind for you. And then later in the same thing, I was like, okay, let's add an AI generation feature to this. It's like a SaaS product we're building in the course. let's add an AI generation feature. And it's like, sure, no problem. Let's use the Google generative AI package. And it's like, well, that's the deprecated one. You know, I probably don't want to use that. And, you know, both of these are things that I think if I, you know, if I go through with that, it probably would have worked. And it would have just caused a lot of problems later down the line.
Yeah.
And so I think there's, you know, often a concern of like, well, I can't, if I can't use AI to just like write code and trust it, and I can't review it very easily, then it becomes really hard to use. And it's one of the tools that are, I guess, is a little bit deceptively hard to use. If you're writing code and you don't write it properly, often you get a very obvious error. Not always, but if you're coding a to-do app and you can't add a to-do, you know there's a problem. You know you specifically did something wrong or didn't use it properly. A lot of times with AI coding, it'll still give you something and it still might even come close to working, but it's not clear, was this a limitation of AI? Was it a limitation of, like, did you not prompt it right? Did you not give it the right tools to be able to check its own work? You know, was this just something that you needed to be more hands-on for? And so all of these combined means it feels like you should just be able to type a prompt in and get the answer, and you can't. And so it requires a little bit more deliberate practice, and it requires that in order to be able to learn as you code as well, which is obviously important.
Yeah. So we don't want to give like the full course content away for free here. But in your opinion,
I can talk about as much as you want. I really don't mind.
What are the things that you really should care about when working with AI for code generation? So you mentioned it, like, be specific in the prompts, like break down the problem into smaller chunks. Is there any general guidance that would help me? Like, people talk a lot about MCP and stuff. So what of those tools are useful to craft a better prompt for the AI to pick it up, like, more reasonably?
Yeah, I think as we develop, without AI, as we develop, there's a lot of things that we need in order to create a solution successfully. And it's easy to take that for granted. You know, we think, oh, well, because this model's been trained on all the internet, it doesn't need all these things. And it's things like, if I'm working with a library, if you told me to develop the solution and said, okay, but you can't look at the documentation, it's like, well, that's a really big handicap. And so, giving the ability to look at the documentation and reference the documentation is important. And there's lots of ways to do that, right? There's MCP servers, like GetMCP is one, or Context7, that provide it in kind of a general way. There's more curated versions, like llms.txt files, or even some libraries have their own MCP server where it's more specific because, like, the creator of that tool curated it for you. And then there's sometimes you need to get even more personalized. And it's the same thing for if you're developing, I'm using web apps as an example a lot, but if you're developing a web app and you told me develop this web app, but you can't, like, run the app locally and then go click and see how it works, like, that would be a huge problem. And so we shouldn't expect a model to do, you know, great work if we don't give it the ability to do these things as well. And so I think the big thing is like, kind of think about what are the things that you would actually need to look at in order to solve this problem. Give those same tools to the model. And then it is a lot of break it down into small steps, work incrementally. That can be hard to do, especially if you get tired. It's tempting just to, like, just do it, you know? Mm-hmm. But that usually leads to not great outcomes. And keep doing the same things you always do, like, care about the quality of the code, not just, you know, not just the output. Keep learning about what you're doing. Break it down into small problems and think about what it would need to be successful. And a lot of times it comes down to, if I spend an hour thinking about how do I give it documentation for my project and how do I give it the right tools, things go 10 times faster. And I often get get pushback. Well, I don't want to spend an hour. And it's like, well, you've been working on this project for 3 months. Like, well, what is an hour to make you a lot more efficient, you know?
That sounds a lot like treating the AI assistants like you would treat a coworker, right? Or like if you onboard a new colleague, you would do the same things, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of commonalities there. Like I think I trust the LLM, the AI coding, a little bit less because I think a lot of the difference comes into whatever I commit or send, if it's an email or if it's a blog post or whatever. Like I'm committing to saying that this is something that I believe is good. And maybe I used AI to write it or maybe not. That doesn't matter. But I have that. I'm saying this is good. And if a coworker or a person or an intern or whoever makes any kind of commit or sends me anything, I kind of expect the same thing. Like this is like they can't say like, oh, yeah, that was totally wrong. That was Gemini. You know, you've seen like news articles of lawyers getting in trouble for that. Like, yeah. That's not like, no, you sent it to me. Like you take accountability for whatever you provided. And I think that's one of the big differences. But, you know, is that, you know, that accountability piece. Like I'm not going to be like, I don't say like, oh, well, Gemini guaranteed this was correct. You know, whereas, you know, a person, I hope they have that care for quality.
Mm. So apart from the obvious trust issues that you have and that you reasonably have with coding agents, what level of seniority would you consider a well-configured coding assistant right now, where we are?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't really think of it that way, right? Like, I think of it as it's a tool that makes me a lot faster. So if I think of it like, if you took away other standard coding tools of mine, my productivity mm-hmm. would drop significantly. If you told me, okay, you can code, you know, here's Notepad, you don't get an IDE, you don't get VS Code or Vim or whatever you use, my productivity would drop. That doesn't mean I couldn't. Like, I could still write some Python scripts. I could still look at the documentation. I could still make it work.
You could still use Notepad.
Right. I mean, there was a viral video a while ago how someone coded up a game in PowerPoint. You know, you could do whatever you want, but you wouldn't be nearly as effective. And I kind of see AI the same way. I don't think of it as having really much of any seniority. I think of it as a tool that's going to make me learn faster, make me work faster. In a lot of problems, it's going to write a lot of the code I'm still, you know, reviewing and refactoring all the time. But yeah, I see it more like, a tool that helps me more than a partner or a developer. Yeah. That's just my own opinion.
That's a great way to put it, actually. Like, the only thing is, it is a tool. But it is a very complicated tool. It looks so nice because you just add something to a chatbot or a text input. But that's not the whole story, right? You need to have all those things in place to make the best out of the tool. So what I was wondering is like the people that are in your course to learn such things, what are those people like? Do they have like cutting edge in like compared to the industry because they know there is something about it that they care about those things? What's the average person in your course doing and what company do they work for?
You know, there's in terms of what company they work for,
we don't need to drop names, but it's just like
there's lists of companies on the landing page, but you know, there's ones from like X and like, you know, all the big tech names that people like to see people from. So you can check there, but there's a variety of companies from big tech to consulting companies to independents and all that. And the range of people that joined the course was actually a much wider spread, you know, than I had thought there would be. Mm. And so defining an average is actually kind of difficult, which is inconvenient marketing wise. But so we've got people who have in the course that are attending the course, that have, created open source libraries that have millions of downloads every month. They're obviously very senior developers. And we have people who are just starting to learn to code, who maybe have just done kind of some of their first coding projects and are looking for help setting up how to get started, how to like install GitHub Copilot, for example. And so, you know, there's people who have been doing, who are part of like the AMP build crew, for example, who AMP does like a, they have like a group of people who do stand-ups and they like build and hold each other accountable and do AI coding. And so there's people who are part of other communities as well that are actively working on this in the course. And again, there's also people who are looking to install and use AI for kind of the first time successfully. So it's, we found that, you know, we have, you know, lectures for the course that covers content. And because of this spread that was wider, what we're actually doing is, you know, for the first week, we recorded lots of breakdown videos. And so in addition to the lectures, we recorded, you know, several hours worth of additional videos just for the course students that break it down in a different way so that everybody can kind of get value rather than trying to have one size fits all. We just recorded more content and delivered it to everybody.
Yeah, got it. The direction I wanted to take with that question was more like, in what environments is it very good to have AI assistance, and in what areas might it not be such a good idea? Or in other words, like, do larger companies, for example, profit in or benefit in a similar way that individual developers? Is there a difference in how they use it? And what is the industry going towards? That's basically the question behind it.
Yeah, I think having it all across the board is helpful. There are some differences between like a solo developer and a team. So for example, as if I'm building a product and it's just me and I like, say, Claude Code, I can tailor all my stuff around Claude Code. Mm. And if I decide I don't like it and I want to switch to Cursor, I can just change all my stuff to Cursor, like no big deal. If I decide I don't like it and I want to try a new thing, I can move it. It's a little bit inconvenient, but it's not a problem. If you have a whole team contributing to something, like in an enterprise setting, that's really problematic, you know, to just like move everything over. And so Eleanor, you know, my co-instructor, she developed a tool called Ruler. It's free. It's a free CLI library where you can define all your context and rules in a central place, and then that allows everybody to distribute it to whatever format the tool uses. So Claude uses Claude.md. A lot of other tools use agents.md. Cursor has the .cursor directory. And so for not just context, but also tools. And so that lets kind of a team co-manage context where like a solo developer wouldn't necessarily need to co-manage the context with anybody else. With larger enterprise teams, like with a startup, a lot of times it's like, well, we're just starting to use AI. We're just starting to build our product. And so they build their context up around what they're trying to do. A lot of times in enterprises, they already have a very mature product. And so they need to build, often prioritize building context around what's already there so that the agents can navigate these really large code bases. You know, ideally you just say, well, just refactor everything and make everything clean and pretty and decoupled. And that's not always an option if you've got code bases with millions of lines of code.
Mm. So would you go so far to say we are again in a situation, David versus Goliath, in a way that like small teams that utilize AI coding assistance could well compete with larger companies with a much bigger headcount?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think it's, you know, every time you have like a big shift in technology, it's like there's the opportunity for people to use that new technology. I think it's, you know, large companies are just, it can be harder or slower to adapt and use new things. But we're seeing, you know, even very large companies are adopting these very quickly. I mean, it happens all the time in the news where you hear about a CEO putting down a memo and a mandate that everyone needs to, you know, learn AI coding and start using it extensively. And so, but yeah, I definitely think that it's pushing it more to where the number of things, like the more decoupled it is just going to add quite a lot of inefficiencies. You know, something that might have taken me, you know, an hour and a half before, if I can get it done in 5 or 10 minutes, why would I have a second person and spend 5 or 10 minutes making a ticket so that they can read the ticket,
yeah,
complete the task, send it back to me to review so I can say that it's completed? I mean, and in large companies, there's so much of that where I think there's a lot of tasks that just creating the ticket and then prioritizing the ticket through whatever review process, giving the ticket to someone and doing the PR process back across departments just takes longer than it does now for the original developer or the original person that needed it to do it themselves.
Mm. So it's all about processes, basically.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's like the boundary of what needs to get kind of moved around. And now I think a lot of times people hear this and they think, oh, well, that means people are going to get laid off. I actually don't think so. I think that things will be, I mean, it's hard to say. I'm not an economist. I don't know how these things work, but I think that it just means that there's less stuff that makes sense for me to ask somebody else to do so I can be more productive. And so I can build more, mm-hmm. but the same is true for that other person. You know, they can be more productive and build more as well. And so my hope is that this just increases productivity and we build more rather than saying we've built enough and leave people behind.
So you kind of answered the question that I'm going to ask you already a bit, but this was kind of the romanticized version. So there's this new disruptive, cool technology that makes us all more productive and stuff. And even smaller teams can compete against large enterprises. But in turn, that would mean, or that would lead to the other question of how disruptive is that to the job market? Will we lose our jobs because we only need a tenth of the people now?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think so. But again, like, I think the question of will people, how much will the economy change? I don't have an economics degree. Like, there's all kinds of public policy things. There's all kinds of regulations that are going in. How all those interplay, how fast this gets adopted. There's like a lot of stuff outside of like the technical developer, the technical, how do you AI code, that I don't know. I don't have expertise in. But my hope at least is that, you know, as we're able to build more and more stuff faster, that we just build more and more stuff faster. My hope is that if I can build twice as much, or if a company can produce twice as much value, I mean, they can either produce twice as much value or they can fire half the people and produce the same amount that they always have. My hope is that they just produce twice as much value and everyone still has a job and we just do better. But again, like, I think there's a lot of
got it.
I think that most of that, most of what's going to happen in the economy and the labor market, I think is, probably tied up in things that aren't strictly technical development and coding.
Yeah, absolutely. Got it. Like, back to the technology, like, we've seen ChatGPT advance, what seems to be very fast, which seems to be exponential. If you compare that to the early versions of GPT, even before it was called ChatGPT, the advances are tremendous. But from the point we are at now, like, you're a data scientist, you know the analogy. But if you are at that point where we are, it might look like exponential, but it might also be actually an S-curve, So a logistic regression with a plateau. So what is your forecast, so to say, on how AI might advance, how much more of capabilities it might get, or are we basically stuck there where we are?
No, I mean, I think it will continue to advance. I don't know exactly how fast. I feel like we're still a ways off from this, this runaway curve thing where AI can be used to improve itself in some endless loop to do this thing and kind of go towards ASI or AGI or whatever. I feel like we're far, far ways away from that. I don't trust it to write Stripe code to handle user payments. And I have tried to have it write Stripe code because I hate writing Stripe code and dealing with those. And, I had it. I tried to work through it. I found, quite a few bugs, and maybe I could have worked through those agentically going back and forth and testing them. But I found it was easier for me to kind of dive in and look at the code. And so and that's something that's done lots and lots of times by lots and lots of businesses. There's lots of code out there. There's clear documentation. It's relatively simple, and so I feel like we're kind of a long ways off from this idea that it's going to get so good that we don't really need people. I think for the foreseeable future, a human using AI as a tool is going to be more productive than giving an AI some sort of loop that it can work on its own. That's my opinion. I don't really know. But I think over time, I don't know. I don't know what the future holds, I guess. I think from what I can tell, the human being very, very, very involved in almost every step is super useful still. And I don't think it's going to be involved in lots and lots and lots to not involved. I think that transition will take some time.
Mm. Absolutely. So another concern that people raise with AI in terms of efficiency is, of course, the energy consumption that it has. Do you think that's something, from a technical point of view, is that something which just needs some more research? Or is that something which is inherently a feature or property of the technology that we have? So in other words, is it really sustainable, or are those positive results driven by companies actually subsidizing their products right now?
Yeah, I do think there's a lot of companies subsidizing their own products. But that's, there's obviously a lot of investment money going in. There's obviously a lot of companies who have big valuations that aren't yet profitable. I haven't looked a lot at it, to be honest. And in terms of the energy consumption, I know that the energy consumption is quite large, but I haven't studied it in depth. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So, I wish I had a better answer for you there, but yeah, I think these models are here to stay. I mean, they obviously use quite a lot of energy. I think the more that we can open source models, the more that we can reuse models, fine-tune them, rather than having every company, one of the worst things I think that could happen energy-wise is if every company has to, in the future, train their own ChatGPT and train their own Claude from scratch. So the more we can open source these so that people can reuse them and use them for inference rather than doing massive training runs over and over, the better. But I don't know the specifics of the energy consumption.
Mm. Did you try to run your own models, open source versions of it? Have you experienced with that topic?
Yeah, I've run some locally, but mostly I use the pre-existing APIs like Gemini and OpenAI and Anthropic's APIs for the most part.
Yeah. So which one did you try locally? Llama or...?
Yeah, I tried Llama. Was the big one. Oh, Llama's got a really nice local endpoint. So most of them, though, like I said, I use like the cloud versions, whether I hit those or for the code completion, I use, you know, AMP and Cloud Code and, you know, other tools like that.
Got it. So when it comes to those agents then, like you mentioned Cloud Code, there's also GitHub Copilot. I think OpenAI just released Codex. There is an open source project with the name of Open Code. There are a lot of those projects. Yeah, we had Dax here on the podcast as well. Talked a little bit about that. I like it very much because it like integrates the language server, which gives a lot of additional context to the LLM. What's your personal favorite?
Oh, well, it's funny. My favorite thing, my favorite feature of these coding tools actually isn't even a feature of these coding tools. There's a company called SpecStory that has an extension, and it saves all of my chats, both locally in Markdown, and then it like saves them in a cloud that they've got that you can search and all that. And it works with Codex and Cloud Code and Cursor and Copilot right now. And that to me is like the thing that I use these tools for a lot, is because whenever I code, I want to write about it. I do, obviously, I've got a couple of courses. I obviously do a lot of teaching. I want to revisit some of the decisions I've made, whether it's blog posts or just share them or a newsletter. And so I use the tools that supports, to be honest. And then I can use that in, I can use those chat histories in Gemini or in, I frequently do that. I've got lots of posts on our blog about, you know, doing that, or I can, you know, look through and chat with the documents, figure out like, why did I choose, like I just did this the other day where I was using TipTap for my editor for a product that I'm working on. And I was like, why did I, like, what were the other things I considered other than TipTap? Because I remembered I looked at like four alternatives and I was like, it was Quill, TipTap, what were the other two? Because I wanted to think about it more. And just having that there was really nice. So,
Do you have an opinion on the models that you use? Are some better than others? I mean, obviously there are, but can you try to name the personalities of different models and from your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think the ones that AMP uses, like, instead of using just one model, they kind of route and direct you to the model that they think is best for the task. So I think like their Oracle model, I think, is 4.4.1, OpenAI's model. But they use a lot of Sonnet. I like Sonnet 4.5. The new Sonnet is really great for coding. I like OpenAI's 4.0 and 4.1. Those are probably the ones I use when I'm doing stuff working with, for like writing posts or things like that. I use a lot of Gemini. So like if I was gonna, you know, take this video and write a blog post about it myself, like it'd be like, well, let me get the raw video and upload the entire video to Gemini and ask Gemini to make an outline of what we talked about or something. Like that would be something that I do use Gemini for a lot. But for coding, yeah, I use a lot of Sonnet.
Okay.
And Opus.
I found that like the new Codex, I think it's Codex 5 or something from OpenAI, that is better on some tasks like bash scripts, whereas Sonnet is better in understanding the entire code base in a way. Are there similar observations that you have about different models?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've found that the, if you're using one of the modern models and you're using any of the modern agents, whether it's AMP or Open Code or Cloud Code or Codex, you know, I've found that it, or Copilot, I've found that it doesn't really make too much of a difference as long as I've set up my context and as long as I've given it the proper tools. If I've done that, I can be successful with any of them. There's differences, but like AMP, I think, is a little bit more aggressive in terms of independence. I mentioned Gemini is great for more writing tasks, which includes documentation. I like Sonnet for the writing. A lot of people really like Codex. It seemed to work really well as well for me. So,
Okay. So coming back to the course that you teach with Eleanor, so what is the basic outline of that? It's from what I recall, it's 2 weeks, right, for people to join?
It was 2 weeks. Now it's 3 weeks because we couldn't fit everything we thought was important in, so we had to extend it to 3 weeks. So it's now a longer course. But yeah, we just finished week one. Week one covers kind of the basics for what are the different methods for coding. So, for example, we cover the inline editing versus terminal agents versus IDE agents, like how do all those work? What's the difference between these generic tools like Context7 or even GitMCP versus, more specific LLMs text stuff or personalized context? Like, when does that trade-off happen? And then we talk about and demo how would you actually work with this. So the homework that we have is a small product demo. It's a feature in a product that I'm building, so we wanted a real product. And we cover how do you create this context, how do you work incrementally with AI, like how do you break it into tasks and then get AI to work in these ways, how do you add MCPs there. So it's really the foundation of this context building for both the documentation, the requirements, the tools, as well as, all the different methods that are available. Next week in week two, we'll cover more on spec first planning, kind of getting even more in detail on that. And looking at diffs and rollback plans and more custom workflows for tools, not just MCPs, but CLI tools as well. Talking about when subagents are useful. They're useful sometimes. I think they're used more than they should be, but they
so
do
what
have
are subagents.
Yeah, so a subagent, like in Claude Code, for example, it's a popular one. A subagent is largely a prompt and a set of tools that you can run. And so if your main, for example, if you have a pull review subagent or a subagent that's going to review your code before you commit it, it might have a subset of your tools. So like all your read-only tools, for example, because you wouldn't, maybe it doesn't need to add it. I just want it to review. Mm-hmm. And it would have a prompt that goes with it. And when you create one, you can go look at the markdown file. That's basically what it is. It's just a, an agent with a smaller scope. It's a different prompt. And so, setting up these kind of really tailored things for specific tasks. And we'll talk about, parallel agents and things like that as well. That kind of leads into using them in like more proactive ways. There's stuff like, I mentioned AI code review, but you can also have that in like GitHub Actions to do pull reviews, things like that, automating it, auditing it, all that kind of stuff. And then finally, week three, we cover more async agents and more advanced techniques around parallelizing them, using them in enterprise settings and workflows, because it's a little bit different than if I just set it up on my personal repo. What are the different architectures for background tasks and running them? All of this is like on the landing page, so you're welcome to, like, anybody can go and check that out if they'd like.
Yeah, we link that down below.
Sweet.
Yeah, so just a quick question about the parallel workflows. Is that like, as you would imagine in a team setting, where different people work on different branches and then there's a review and then they're all merged into main? Or is that really like working different instances of a CLI tool in parallel on a computer? How does it work? Like, how does it scale up?
Yeah, there's different people that have different workflows. So like, I forget who it was, but someone posted what they do is they have like seven different Claude codes running in different terminal windows. That sounds a little chaotic to me. I'm like, that's too much for my brain. Like my biggest problem with agents is not that they can't create enough code for me. You know, like that's not usually my problem. But for some tasks that are super easy and fast to review, that can be really helpful. So, you know, for example, I recently did a PR to an open source library where we just needed to add type hints to a whole bunch of places. It's not particularly hard work. It's not particularly hard to review. And so, you know, I felt like I could send multiple agents off on different parts of the code base, different repositories, and have them all working to add type hints. And then as they came through, I could review them. I probably could have tried to have one agent do it, but that was just convenient. There's other tools that make this that are built around this idea. So Conductor is one. You should check that out. But basically, it's a tool designed around having multiple Claude codes running in parallel, and it makes managing those threads very easy and reviewing the changes and popping into the editor and all that very easy. And so there's it's like an IDE for multiple Claude codes.
Mm. So in practice, how did you do that with the multiple PRs to that open source library? Did you really have like such an extension, or did you have like a multiple CLI tools running at the same time, or did you run?
So them I just GitHub had multiple or? Multiples. Yeah, I had multiple CLIs running at the same time, and what I did is I went and once I reviewed them all, I just merged for everything, so it was just like one PR per repo. Mm. I could have submitted multiple PRs, but I felt like it would be easier for the repo owner to review it if it was combined, because it was all just type hints. Mm-hmm. And so I combined it because I thought it'd be easier for them to review it that way. But
got it.
Again, I think it's like I think about it as it's a tool for me. And so like even if it however it happens here, like I'm sending it to them, so I need to put it in a way that I feel is good quality. So
yeah. So is that also the reason why these CLI tools are so prominent right now? I mean, there are like tools like Copilot or Kiro, which are or Cursor, which have like a more integrated approach, but people tend to go back to these CLI tools. Is that because they can run multiple instances of them, or is there something more to it?
Well, I think Copilot is really, really common. It doesn't get talked about that much, but using Copilot in VS Code in the integrated terminal is super popular. Cursor is still pretty popular. It's been mm-hmm. talked about less recently, but we recently did a study. Like these tools are maybe not getting as much buzz, but they're still used quite a bit. The CLI tools have some advantages. One, you can run them anywhere. You can easily spin up multiple versions of it, run them in a subdirectory. So maybe you want to, maybe you've got a repo open and you want to write some tests, but you don't want the agent to write tests based on what the app does. You want it to like write tests not knowing what the app does, because if it just tests what actually is there, it doesn't test anything. So maybe you want to run the terminal agent from inside the test directory so it can't even see the app. So that's convenient with the terminal agent. And I also think it's really nice that these terminal agents are not dictating what IDE you use. Mm-hmm. So you can use Claude Code or Open Code with Vim or WinSurf or VS Code or JetBrains. And so it's kind of nice that they're there. And these integrations being built mean you can use these terminal agents with the IDE very easily. So for example, if you are using the Claude Code extension with VS Code or with Cursor, and you're running Claude Code in the terminal of VS Code, the diffs actually show up in the editor diffs. And so it acts as if it's part of the IDE rather than a completely separate tool.
Not that idea.
And Zed does that as well. So.
Oh, yeah. That is also a very cool new editor. So it's Zed.dev, I guess. But that's
I really
also
like
something
Zed.
You might Yeah, it's very cool. It's pretty fast. It's entirely written in Rust, if I recall correctly. Yeah, it's a cool thing. So if there is someone now listening and say, okay, I've never gone beyond that stage of like trying to prompt and get it all, and that never worked. So apart from obviously attending your course, what would be a good way to start? Like, can you recommend any resources? What is a good way to just get started if you want to use AI more seriously?
Yeah, we have a blog post, a blog, Substack. It's elite-ai-assisted-coding.dev. So if you check that out, there's tons of guides and tips and tricks and things like that. If you go to our landing page, if you scroll down, there's several free resources that you can download. You just like put in an email address and you can download. So there's several free things there that you can look at. Some LLM context for fast HTML, whether you use fast HTML or not, you can kind of see how it's built at least. And there's several other pieces of free information. So follow me and Eleanor because we frequently put out free stuff as well. Follow that Substack. We have lots of talks on there from different vendors and from talking about different topics as well. Recently, we did a talk where we built an AI coding agent from scratch using AI. So that's a great thing to watch. Even if you don't want to build an AI coding agent, you can see how the process that went through, and Eleanor was building this, the process that she went through for creating the prompts and building it. And so you can actually watch it done live. So that's a great way. And also, just if you have questions and don't know how to do something, just like tag us on social media and ask us, or DM us and ask us. Like I'm pretty open to answering questions, you know, over there. It's and honestly, most of my blog posts now are someone asking me a question and I'm like, oh, I'll go write that and tell everybody. So
Yeah, very cool.
yeah, just ask us.
Okay, so and that course that ran as like a live course, so it's not a video course or something. So, if people got curious now, will there be another version, another cohort, or?
Yeah, we're planning a second cohort in January. As of right now, I don't know how soon this podcast will be published, but as of right now, the registration of this current cohort is in because it is recorded, and so you can catch up a bit. But it will be closing very soon, and so then we'll open up registration for the next cohort, and you can join the January cohort at that point.
Yeah, very cool. So, yeah, that was a lot of insight. Thank you for that.
Oh, this was great.
So,
Yeah, thanks for having me.
and maybe as a last word, don't be scared that AI takes our jobs. We are just building more. I love the way you put that.
Yeah, I think just focus on like what value you can provide today and how you provide value and what value you can do. Like it's going to change as tools change. And I think if you stay on top of it and you stay current with the best ways that you can build things, I think you'll be fine.
That's really cool. That was really cool last words. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Bye.
Bye.